You're listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. Podcast to Practice brings you expert-led independent medical education discussions, inspiring healthcare professionals to maximize their learning and make measurable changes in their own clinical practice.
This podcast is part of an independent medical education program entitled the AML Expert Series, Innovations in Molecular Testing, Emerging Therapies and Targeted Treatments. It is intended for healthcare professionals only and is supported by an independent educational grant from Rigel.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to our medical education program called Advancing AML Treatment, Evidence-Based Regimens and Guidelines for Refractory and Relapse Acute Myeloid Leukemia. And my name is Amer Zeidan, and I'm a professor of medicine at Yale University, and I focus on the management of patients with acute myeloid leukemia and MDS. And it's my pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Wang. Eunice, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, thank you so much. My name is Dr. Eunice Wang, and I'm a professor of oncology and the chief of the leukemia service at the Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in Buffalo, New York. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. So in the context of this discussion, we are going to be talking about the management of refractory and relapsed acute myeloid leukemia, focusing on some of the new evidence supporting the use of novel drugs, and we have seen a number of them approved, as well as discuss the guidelines for the management of those patients and how do we decide on the choice of the treatment for those patients. So maybe to start with, Eunice, maybe you can introduce us to the guidelines that you think are most helpful for our colleagues in the community and how do they approach patients with refractory relapse acute myeloid leukemia, especially those with targetable mutations such as FLT3 and IDH mutations.
Yeah, that's great. So I think in the community, it's really important to recognize that there are a number of guidelines that have come out over the last few years. There was ASCO clinical practice guidelines in 2020. There was the ASH clinical guidelines for management of older AML patients newly diagnosed. And as always, there are the NCCN guidelines, which are updated on an annual basis. And we do have the most recent version of that from 2025. And all of these guidelines really highlight for the community provider that's taking care of patients with acute myeloid leukemia or suspected acute myeloid leukemia, the importance of doing a complete mutational profile and diagnostic workup in any suspected patients. Now, the NCCN, which is the most recently updated guideline, really stresses that comprehensive mutational profile done at the time of diagnosis as well as the time of relapse is really key to selection of the appropriate therapy for these patients. And these include what we call actionable or targetable molecular aberrations, including FLT3, IDH1, IDH2, as well as a number of what we call secondary mutations, which have been identified in the last classification system, the European Leukemia Net, as being diagnostic of what we were used to call secondary leukemias. So I think it's imperative that we all take the time to run those analyses. I think the NCCN does emphasize that expedient obtaining of the results is key for selection of therapy. And for patients that have relapsed AML, the initial NCCN guideline says it's really important to identify, for example, the same mutations, IDH1, IDH2, and FLT3, particularly for older patients who are not eligible for intensive chemotherapy. So I think that's a change from in the past where just morphological confirmation of AML or maybe flow was the only thing that we needed.
Yeah, and I think that's very important. Clearly, as similar to other tumors, we kind of transition into this individualized or personalized approach of choosing therapies rather than treating all patients with refractory disease the same way. And I think it does also emphasize the need to get molecular assessment, not only at the time of diagnosis, but also at the time of relapse, because of the new drugs that are available. And I think some of these drugs such as IDH inhibitors have been important IDH mutations occur in around 15 to 20% of patients, primarily IDH2, but IDH1 also is relatively rare, but certainly we see it around 5 to 7% of patients have those mutations. So maybe you can walk us, Eunice, through the approved drugs for patients with IDH1 mutation and how do you kind of describe the mechanism of action of those drugs?
Sure. So IDH1 or isocitrate dehydrogenase is something that we remember maybe from biochemistry, the Krebs cycle when we were in medical school. And it's actually a very unique mechanism of tumor genesis or leukemia genesis in this situation. So what happens is that typically this isocitrate dehydrogenase gene catalyzes transformation of isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate, which then is really important for the Krebs cycle, normal metabolism, et cetera. When you have a mutation in this IDH1 enzyme, what happens is it then converts this alpha-ketoglutarate to this, what we call an oncometabolite, 2-HG. And this elevated levels of this 2-HG actually affect chromatin modification and actually lead to differentiation arrest. So these leukemia cells are stuck in a very immature stage. What happens is when you block that particular mutant enzyme, you are able to revert the 2-HG backwards. And so you get rid of this oncometabolite. And then the cells actually differentiate and undergo terminal apoptosis. So it's not a drug like conventional cytotoxic chemotherapies that target really rapidly growing cells that we're really used to. It's actually what we term a differentiation agent. So the small molecule inhibitors that convert or target that mutant enzyme, there's actually two of them in the market. Ivosidenib was approved several years ago, first small molecule inhibitor targeting the mutant IDH1, and olutasidenib was actually approved a couple years ago as a second generation small molecule inhibitor. And both of these result in complete remission rates without incomplete hematologic recovery, about 20 to 30%. Olutasidenib, which was the most recent agent, has about an overall response rate of 48%. Ivosidenib as a single agent in the relapsed refractory setting, similar. The difference, I think, in the two agents are maybe a little bit in their side effects, but also in the fact that with the olutasidenib, even though only about the same percentage of patients went into remission or had a response, the duration of response that we saw with the olutasidenib was much longer, with a median duration not of 11 or 12 months, but actually up to 29 months. And we know now, like a lot of our older patients treated with lower intensity therapy, venetoclax, azacitidine-based therapy, can recur. And olutasidenib, interestingly enough, has been shown to actually work in patients in the relapse setting that have received prior venetoclax. So we have a couple of agents to target it. And I think I would agree with you that at the time of relapse, it's imperative to really recheck for these mutations. They're very uncommon, but we do get clonal evolution and we get selection of different clones and emergence of different clones. So even if there's a chance that maybe 1 out of 10 of your patients has an IDH1 mutation, it can be really key in being able to offer these oral chemotherapy drugs with response rates just to single agent therapy.
Yeah, thank you so much for this excellent summary. So I think, Eunice, in the refractory relapse setting with both of those drugs, both of them were approved based on single arm trials because it's a relatively rare subset of AML and there is no big kind of randomized trials comparing these drugs clearly. So how do you decide on which one to use in your clinic and how do you kind of advise oncologists in practice to decide? Do you do a CML-like approach where you go by comorbidities or is it by one drug being once a day versus twice a day or how do you decide?
I think just like people choose other tyrosine kinase inhibitors or small molecule inhibitors, a little bit of it is an art, not necessarily a science. I think that there are clearly differences. Ivosidenib and olutasidenib, both IDH1 inhibitors. There are slight differences. Both of them result in differentiation syndrome, which is something that we see with acute promyelocytic leukemia, weight gain, pulmonary infiltrates, effusions, pericardial effusions. So that's something that we see commonly on both. I think that my preference would be to kind of see what I think would be the best benefit for patients. I know that there's a lot of data with ivosidenib. We've clearly used it in the upfront setting. I think that it depends a little bit on pretreatment. A lot of us with our IDH1 mutated patients, if we're doing that diagnostic workup at the time of diagnosis, patients may be treated per the randomized trial. There is randomized trials of these IDH inhibitors, but you're right, not in the relapse refractory setting. But we have the AGILE trial, right, in the upfront setting that randomized patients with IDH1 mutant AML to receive ivosidenib, azacitidine versus azacitidine alone with clear superiority for the ivo-aza. So I think if a patient has already received ivosidenib in the upfront setting, I'm more likely, obviously, not to reuse that drug. I also think that there's good data with olutasidenib in patients who've got venetoclax azacitidine up front. There's some anecdotal data, again, not randomized, that patients who got ven-aza up front don't do as well with ivosidenib. So I think a lot of it is obviously selection of the drug and side effects. There's a little bit of QTC prolongation. But I think a lot of it is what did they get in the upfront setting.
Yeah, and I think you summarized very nicely some of the discussion about the combinations as well as the sequencing. And I think you highlighted that olutasidenib might potentially work better based on limited evidence after venetoclax failure compared to ivosidenib. But I'm interested from your kind of clinical experience outside of the literature. How was your personal experience with both of those agents?
I think both of the agents are really well tolerated. I think that there is a risk, and I think it's even a black box warning for ivosidenib and enasidenib, the IDH2 inhibitors, that these can induce differentiation syndrome. And we have seen evidence of differentiation syndrome with all of these agents, all the IDH inhibitors. But if you're on the lookout for it and you're able to manage it, I think that that's not a huge barrier. I think that in my hands, both olutasidenib and ivosidenib have been very, very well tolerated, both as single agents and as well as in some combination studies within the upfront setting. I haven't had major toxicities, and we have actually seen patients that do very, very well. Ivosidenib is also indicated not only in the upfront setting in combination with AZA or as monotherapy, but ivosidenib is also indicated for patients that have IDH1 mutant MDS. And again, in all of these settings, I've seen evidence of count recovery responses that you have to remember that these are differentiation agents. So as I'm sure in your experience as well, which I'd love to hear about, you can't expect that patients are going to have a response within one or even two or three cycles. So as long as they're tolerating drug and you're supporting them with transfusions and so forth, you need to hang in there. You know, we saw with both olutasidenib and with ivosidenib that the patients do maybe 20, 30% get transfusion independence if they're transfusion independent at baseline, but it's at like 56 days. So it's important to recognize supportive care as long as these patients are tolerating it and to wait for a response. And we've had some very nice responses, particularly in older patients who aren't eligible for transplant. High quality of life is something that they treasure. And the oral administration and tolerability, I think, is a key advantage of these drugs. And again, you know, you think to yourself, well, why would I want to check for these IDH mutations? They're so rare, like you said, you know, 5, 10%, mostly at most 20% for all the IDH inhibitors. But I think if you have the option to offer a precision medicine approach with these agents, I think it's really worth it.
Yeah, and my experience has been largely along the lines of your experience. I think these drugs in the relapse refractory setting are clearly effective, well-tolerated oral options. They don't cure patients. So clearly, I think we need better kind of combinations and treating patients more in the frontline setting. But I think I have actually struggled to kind of differentiate between the two agents in terms of how, both of them have somewhat relatively limited data in the relapse refractory setting. But to my eye, there's a lot of similarities, similar to what you said also in the IDH1 mutated MDS. In the second line setting, ivosidenib is the approved drug, but actually olutasidenib has also evidence and is actually NCCN and kind of listed as an option in that setting. I think in the frontline setting in combination with azacitidine, clearly I think we have the agile data. So this is, I think, a situation where we have phase three kind of level. So I tend to do ivosidenib more in that setting. But in terms of like monitoring for the QTc and differentiation syndrome and, you know, liver enzyme issues, etc., I think I tend to think of them similarly. I would say maybe ivosidenib might be a little bit more easy to give because once a day compared to twice a day with olutasidenib. But I think overall the two drugs are kind of very similar. Eunice, you started kind of talking about some of the patient experiences and especially older patients who I think, you know, when they have limited survival with these kind of advanced situations with the refractory relapse AML, the survival is generally less than a year. And it's important to try to keep the patient out of the hospital and with the best of quality of life as possible. Not sure if you can think of one or two kind of success stories or situations where you thought that these drugs kind of made a huge difference.
Well, I think that one of the key differences, I think, between the two agents, and I agree with you, they're both really well tolerated, you know, once a day versus twice a day. I think one of the puzzling things, and I don't know that we know the reason for this, is that in the trial that led to olutasidenib's approval, and these were largely, I would agree, ivosidenib naive and venetoclax naive patients in the majority, the median duration of response in those 153 patients in that trial was an astonishing 29 months. Which is just unheard of for patients in the relapse refractory setting to have a survival of over 2 years. And there's recent 5-year data following for the olutasidenib that demonstrated that even 4 years out, there were some patients that were alive. So I think that I don't know and understand why that is. I mean, they seem like they're similar compounds, obviously newer generation, but that has me intrigued. I do have some patients that have maybe gotten upfront therapy with Ven/Aza approached. I really am tending to prefer the IDH plus Aza for upfront therapy of my IDH mutant patients because I feel like that's a great approach and you don't get the same toxicities with long-term administration that you get with venetoclax HMA for these patients. And I do have patients that have been on long-term IDH1, IDH2 with ivo, enasidenib, and olutasidenib that are out 2 or 3 years just taking monotherapy as an outpatient. I mean, I think I have a patient who's in his 80s and just is taking an IDH inhibitor. And finally, we've mainly moved to seeing him every 3 months because he's like, again, he's like month 29 or 30, 32. And he just doesn't see a purpose in coming to see me every month if he's doing so well on monotherapy. So I think there are those patients for whom these drugs offer the possibility of a long-term survival. I mean, I think that there are certain things. There are certainly resistance mechanisms that have been documented. Patients that have co-mutations in RAS tend not to respond as well, and so forth. But I think that overall, to start thinking about integrating them, even for those rare populations, I think it is great. Similarly, some of these patients, we're doing less toxic allogeneic stem cell transplantations. And so some of these elderly individuals, if you're able to get them into remission, even though it's only 20 or 30%, you might render them possibly candidates for transplant, although I don't have any of those per se in my practice.
Yeah, this is, I think, a very nice outline. We are kind of running short on time, but I think like the main message is the importance of molecular testing and looking for mutations and individualizing the therapy for patients with acute myeloid leukemia. And while these mutations, the IDH mutations, are relatively rare, we have good, effective oral drugs that are generally well tolerated, and I think are important to think about when we see these patients. Eunice, any closing remarks?
Sure. I think one key take-home message is one must do the mutation profiling at diagnosis as well as at relapse to identify what we call actionable or targetable mutations for which there now are oral, well-tolerated, safe medications that result in true CRs and in some cases, long-term remissions.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Wang, for this excellent discussion. And thank you to the audience for listening. And I encourage everybody to listen to the video podcast series and the upcoming episode 3, which will focus on the mechanisms of action and the safety profile of IDH1 inhibitors. Thank you so much for listening and have a good day.
Thank you for listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. For more information on our educational programs available, visit ime.springerhealthcare.com.